Welcome to the April edition of A Foreign Affair.
To walk the road of peace, sometimes we need to be ready to climb the mountain of conflict.
Tommy said, Mr. President, you're wrong. Now that takes a lot of guts.
I'm for peace and quiet, Mr. Lute. It's why I came to the UN. Quiet diplomacy.
Yes, well, quiet diplomacy does seem to be the need of the moment. Whose version of the pandemic that we're going through is likely to prevail? And today, my three guests will consider what the virus has revealed about the global superpowers, the US and China, and the different ways in which it's flawed them. I see that the Australian Foreign Affairs Weekly sort of said, the United States or China? Neither, thanks. So as our two major partners stumble a bit, where does that leave Australia? A question that's been on the mind of foreign policy experts for some time. Now many of them feel its time has really come. So joining me, I'm delighted to say, are John Prideaux, the US editor of The Economist. He's been writing about US politics for 7 years and he hosts the podcast Checks and Balance. Welcome back, John.
Thank you for having me.
And to steer us through China in all its various glories, Richard McGregor, the senior fellow at the Lowy Institute, and no stranger to Saturday Extra listeners, a very skilled observer of China. Hello, Richard.
Hi, Geraldine.
And I'm also joined by Alan Gingell, the national president of the Australian Institute of International Affairs. He too has a podcast. It's called Australia in the World, which I'm a great listener to. A warm welcome to you, Alan.
Thanks very much, Geraldine.
Now, John, to you first, and a general question to kick us off. How would you describe United States morale at the moment?
It's not great, to be honest. I mean, there are several different ways of looking at it, I suppose. The one that political obsessives like me tend to focus on are the president's approval ratings. So take that one first. In most Western democracies, the approval rating of the president or prime minister has jumped during this crisis. There's something about this kind of crisis that makes people feel warmly about their leader. So you've seen that, you know, all over the world. In America, President Trump's approval ratings went up by a couple of points, but then went back to where they were again. So I think America lacks that sort of unified feeling in national politics. State politics is a bit different. State governors in America are seeing their approval ratings enjoy a real bounce up to levels that you really wouldn't normally see, you know, sort of 80%, that sort of thing. So I think there's a certain amount of kind of national unity and fellow feeling, but it's on a kind of local level. The degree to which things are processed through national politics and through, you know, President Trump versus Democrats in Washington, it's a real picture of kind of disunity and in a way sort of a quite shocking failure to put the kind of party fighting aside and unite the country. But, you know, maybe that's no surprise to anyone who's as familiar with American politics as you are, Geraldine.
Well, look, you know, it does seem like a bit of an addiction. Of course, the President Donald Trump says we're not being told the whole story. Let's listen a bit to his recent White House briefing.
There's no stories. What a great job we've done with ventilators. We're now supplying ventilators all over the world because no other country could have done what we did. And you should say, that's a great story. Instead, you say, Trump was slow. We were so fast. Plus, we put the ban on so much earlier. If we didn't, and Dr. Fauci said this, if we didn't close our country to China, we would have been so infected like nobody's ever seen. When you saw the chart, and we were at the top of the list in terms of success, nobody wrote it. I said, is anybody going to use that chart? Nobody wrote it in terms of mortality. You saw that. Germany and our country, the most successful in terms of mortality. Nobody wrote it. It would be great if you wrote the truth.
So that's Donald Trump talking to reporters. Now, what I'm keen for in this segment is to see how this is playing out in terms of international prestige. America's sense of being the exceptional nation, which is very deep, John, isn't it? Is that taking a battering from within, let alone from without, or not?
I think it has taken a battering during this crisis. I mean, America, understandably, is preoccupied with deaths from coronavirus in its own country. It's now the country, unfortunately, with more deaths than any other country from the virus. So it's, to a degree, it's understandable that America's taken a bit of an inward turn. But ordinarily, in a global health crisis like this, you would expect the United States to be trying to encourage some sort of international cooperation, provide some leadership. The Centers for Disease Control, which is, you know, one of the best outfits at what it does anywhere in the world, be kind of going around offering other governments advice. That just hasn't happened this time. And quite a lot of countries that normally you would count as being within the American sphere of influence have been turning to China principally to get help, just in terms of sort of gear during this outbreak. So I think it has taken a battering. I wouldn't go as far to say it's irretrievable. I think America's got plenty of good things going for it. But yes, right at the moment, it has. And that's a mixture of sort of non-Trump factors and Trump factors, I would suggest.
I just wonder whether there's a sense of whether it's been such a shock, this. I was reading a man called Nicholas Eberstadt, who's quite a big thinker over there in terms of particularly Asian interaction with America. And he said, indeed, the pandemic appears to be the intellectual equivalent of an unexpected asteroid strike for almost all who must cope in these unfamiliar new surroundings. You know, that's presumably the Beltway and others, people who are practiced at being calm because they know they've got the biggest military, et cetera, et cetera. I just wonder whether you can see missteps there or confusion and bewilderment.
Yes. So two things there. In terms of the shock, I mean, early on, speaking to people in New York, which has been the center of the COVID-19 outbreak in America so far, you know, it may well spread to other parts later. But talking to New Yorkers, they sort of said, you know, we are a bit complacent. We see things happening in Northern Italy, hospitals being overwhelmed. You don't really think it's going to happen in New York, and then it does. And so it's shocking on that level. And lack of preparedness, yeah, I think that's right. I mean, almost every country, I think, was sort of unprepared for this. It's, on the one hand, a risk that everybody knew was there. You know, you can go back and look at congressional briefings, you know, presidential advice, going back years and years saying, you know, this is a real risk and we need to prepare for it. On the other hand, because it feels sort of distant and unlikely, people in government have prioritized things that seemed kind of more urgent and more likely and are now regretting that. But in the American context, there were some, you know, kind of real failures early on that, notwithstanding what President Trump said about closing the borders to China, set America back hugely. So one was just a bureaucratic failing. The Centers for Disease Control, which I mentioned already, sent out a whole load of testing kits that didn't work. And America lost about a month at a crucial moment when it could have kept a lid on the virus if it had been doing proper testing, and it wasn't. And then I think you add to that a whole load of coordination problems between states and the federal government and, frankly, unhelpful messaging and leadership right from the top.
We'll move on to the China discussion because obviously that's pertinent here and we'll come back. China is also bumbling around, it would seem, Richard McGregor. And the news this week has been our government calling for a global inquiry into the origins of the coronavirus. This is how we heard about it when Foreign Minister Maurice Payne announced on the ABC TV's Insiders program.
Well, we need to know the sorts of details that an independent review would identify for us about the genesis of the virus, about the approaches to dealing with it and addressing with it, about the openness with which information was shared, about interaction with the World Health Organization, interaction with other international leaders. All of those sorts of things will need to be on the table. It will need parties, countries, to come to the table with a willingness to be transparent and to engage in that process, and also ensure that we have a review mechanism in which the international community can have faith.
Now, it's been fascinating to watch, I think, Richard McGregor, the impact of this is part of a growing sense that there has to be a better explanation anyway from China, even if it's cooperatively sought than they've provided thus far. And particularly fascinating to watch their famed diplomatic corps make misstep after misstep. And we can talk about the extraordinary sort of clunkiness in France, where forcing the French foreign minister to defend their nursing staff. I mean, really?
Yes, well, that's what they call China's wolf diplomacy. we can come back to whether Australia was engaging in a lighter version of wolf diplomacy with the demand for an independent inquiry. I'll just talk about that briefly, and we might come back to that. I mean, initially Australia and other countries were calling for greater transparency, which of course is absolutely right. Calling for an independent inquiry without, you know, coordinating such a call with a bunch of other countries seems a little bit odd, because there's almost nothing less likely that China would agree to than foreigners, you know, tramping through Wuhan on their own independently to get to the bottom of what happened, as right and proper as that might be. But as you say, I mean, I think you're right when you say, you know, a lot of people think, oh, gosh, China's won and America is going down the tube. Certainly America is flailing on any number of fronts. But the idea that China is through this, I think, is obviously wrong.
Well, quite. I mean, I was reading Peter Jennings' writing from the ASPI, Australian Strategic Policy Institute, who's quite a China hawk, on Saturday, sort of saying, my goodness, they're making gigantic leaps. And I thought, well, you know, they've got a range of countries from the old Soviet Union and Europe really reacting and arcing up about some of the very culturally insensitive ways in which they're progressing. I think it's been a real surprise. I think they're sort of doing a lot of own goals.
Well, the France and Germany, and to a lesser extent, are very interesting countries to watch, because they're the sorts of countries that China wants to cultivate as relations with the US fall apart. And, you know, in the early stages, when China was, you know, the first into the crisis, it got a lot of help, materials, medical equipment and the like, from European countries. The Chinese said to the European countries... That's right. The Chinese said to these countries at the time, please don't make a big deal about this, and they didn't. And, of course, when the roles were reversed and China sent supplies in the opposite direction, they demanded ceremonies at the airport and big presentations and the like. And that put people off. And then we had the announcement on the Chinese website of the Chinese embassy in Paris criticising how French were treating their patients. And, of course, that just set people off. So it's a time when China could have been making great strides, but they are alienating all manner of people. It's not irretrievable, but they're alienating all manner of people with a lack of diplomacy at a very important time.
Well, in fact, that's also provoking some people in America. And America is turning very anti-China. And I'm going to ask you and John whether you think it is going to play a particular role in the election. Some people are saying, look, this is just bringing to a head what has been bubbling away there for a while. There are very different systems, very different values, very different sensibilities, and they have been there. And we haven't cared to sort of name them, as it were. Do you think that that is right, Richard?
Absolutely. I mean, we've always said, you know, the rivalry or the contest between the US and China, it's about trade, it's about geopolitics, it's about the region, it's about technology. Ultimately, it's about a contest of systems. And this, you know, is the perfect arena for that to play out. And obviously, you know, internally, Chinese propaganda at the moment, the big focus is on how our system worked and how democratic systems, most importantly, the US, are failing. Now, whether that plays out in that direction over time, certainly for the Chinese, it's absolutely a contest of systems. As to the election, obviously, it's going to be a big issue in the US election. You can see that already, and John will know better than me, but in the way we've already got rival ads between Biden and Trump on the issue of China. So they're both going to be hammering at that issue.
And just before I go back to John, nevertheless, Richard, you have met, as I have met, some extremely sophisticated operators from China who would, they must hate some of the way this is turning out for China, even if they can't say it out loud. Is there any suggestion that the people who really matter there might turn against Xi Jinping? I mean, you've been wondering about this for a while, but it seems to me to have been a complete mess in the last 10 days?
Well, on a number of levels, she's already got a lot of domestic critics who really can't organise against him, but they're all there and a couple have been locked up in recent weeks. There's also broader anger about, you know, the management of the lockdown and the like. There are a lot of critics on that. They've also been shut up recently. In terms of diplomacy, there's obviously a big split in the Chinese diplomatic establishment or foreign ministry between the older, more traditional diplomats and the so-called wolf diplomats, the one, you know, the current deputy spokesman at the foreign ministry who was openly spreading conspiracy theories from the podium. And you know, the ambassador, Chinese ambassador to the US basically disowned him. It's not a fundamental split in the system, but there's a big split on how to manage this.
And John, how incendiary will it be in the election or not? Will everybody calm down by the time November arrives?
No, I think it's going to be a big deal in the election in November, partly because relations with China are one of the big questions facing America. I mean, the traditional line on foreign policy is it tends not to matter that much in presidential elections. But the thing about China policy is that President Trump is strategically keen to make it a domestic issue, not just a foreign policy issue. And he sees it as a kind of winning issue for him against Joe Biden, who he's tried to paint as a more kind of typical establishment foreign policy person, you know, part of the kind of failed foreign policy elite that thought that as China grew richer, it would democratize and open up and become a, you know, a more kind of regular, you know, sort of Western-type society. So he thinks he's onto a winner there, so he will bang on about it a lot. You mentioned in passing this contest, well, not just in passing, this contest of values. I think that's very interesting. You know, if you look at countries like France and Germany, they do have an overlap in terms of kind of interests with China in some area, you know, kind of most obviously on economic matters and trade, but also on things like climate change. They have really zero overlap in terms of, you know, values. Nobody's pretending that China's example in combating COVID-19 is going to mean that Germans or French people are more likely to be enthusiastic about a kind of one-party state where dissidents are locked up. So really, China doesn't have a whole lot to offer those countries in terms of values. And of course, so the argument that China likes to make internally about how their system is best for dealing with pandemics like this, you know, there are obviously plenty of democratic regimes that have done a really good job. You know, I point to Germany and South Korea as two examples.
We think we have, John.
Well, exactly. I just didn't want to flatter you guys too much, but I mean, obviously that's true as well. We take for granted that Australia will handle its business well.
Oh, very good. So, mind you, despite all that you're saying there, some wiser heads too have said, look, it'll sort of have to dawn on people that for both countries, the US and China to thrive, they are inextricably intertwined in terms of economically and in terms of keeping the world peaceful, then people will have to come to grips with this before it gets out of hand. So can you see?
The interesting thing is, if you look at the sort of most nationalistic, make America great again sort of strain in American politics, some people see this as a real opportunity to sort of decouple. You know, they like the idea of China and America not being codependent. You know, they like the idea of companies moving their supply chains kind of back closer to home. And so they're enthusiastic about a world where the two superpowers are less codependent.
All those treasury bonds held by China, US treasury bonds?
Well, exactly.
That Alan Gingell, I'm going to come to you now. You've been very patient. And whether, from an Australian perspective, after several years of mentioning this, has the time come to really think again as to who we as a country can trust and on whom our security depends? Before I get your thoughts about this, Alan Gingell, I'd like to play some comments Hugh White, pretty blunt ones, made during a recent interview on RN's Breakfast program. He was asked if we can still rely on the US.
Look, it's extraordinarily challenging, and I think, you know, this is the really big question. This is the decades-long question for Australia. I don't think we can any longer rely on the United States to play the role that America has played for us in making Asia safe for us for so long. And I think this is a truly epoch-making change in Australia's international setting. And I think the pandemic, for the reasons we've touched on, amplifies and accelerates that trend. And the question, you know, can we look for another ally? I don't think we can this time. I mean, we relied on Britain for a couple of centuries and then the British faded. And miraculously, America was there to take its place. This time, there's no new great and powerful friend, as Menzies called them. There's no new great and powerful friend for us to turn to. So much more than ever before in our history, we have to think about how we make our way in Asia by ourselves. And I think that's something that as a people, as a society, and we're unprepared for. And I think it's something that our governments, that our political leaders have failed to prepare us for. So I think it's one of the great challenges in our history.
That's Hugh White, Professor of Strategic Studies at the ANU, speaking to Fran Kelly. Now, Alan, as Hugh said, questions about how we interact with the US have been in play for quite some time. Do you think the virus has made this more urgent? And I wonder where it takes us next.
I think the virus has brought things to a head quicker than we might have expected. Geraldine, as you say, the trends that we're talking about have been running for some time now. But in both Beijing and in Washington, you can see, as John was talking about in the election campaign there, things coming to a head. And for Australia, that means that we have to focus on the fact that our interests in all of this differ from those of both Washington and Beijing. Our interests are simply not the same. So we can't rely on the United States in the way we once were able to do to protect our interests in the way we used to, because we're going to come out of this with a more decoupled world than we've known.
So who do we turn to?
Well, we turn to ourselves. I mean, we do have to work much more sort of energetically with the partners around Australia who share some of our interests, not all of the interests all of the time. The other big powers in this region, like Japan, like Korea, Indonesia, like India, in some areas, in an effort to try to fulfil what has been one of Australia's longest objectives in foreign policy, which is the creation of a region around us in which all voices are heard and in which Australia can play a role. So, you know, we're going to have to just abandon the idea that there's someone out there to rescue us from all of this and rely on ourselves. Now, you know, I don't think, as John was saying, that, you know, the United States is not going to go away and disappear, and we'll still have many common interests. But all our interests won't be served by Washington, and that will be particularly true if President Trump is re-elected at the end of the year. And the sort of America First policies that we've seen, the turning the back on leadership in the world becomes even clearer.
But, you know, how do we translate this for people who are not involved in foreign affairs, who are listening? That was Hugh White's great challenge in that interview. He said, look, I just don't think a succession of governments have prepared people, Australian people, for this. You know, Peter Varghese, the former head of the Foreign Affairs, says Australia cannot bully or buy its way in the world. So how do you see the way in which we discuss all this changing?
I think we've got to be blunter and more direct and more honest. We've got to abandon a lot of the sentimentality of the language that we use, particularly with regards to the alliance. I mean, the 100 years of mateship stuff that we've all grown used to. We've got to recognise the enduring importance of foreign policy and diplomacy as key to the way in which we make our own way in this part of the world.
I even wonder, I mean, presumably you are meaning countries like Singapore and Vietnam, I presume, and Indonesia. I mean, you've mentioned South Korea and so on. Do we, like, we're a middle power. Some of those are bigger than that, but we've had quite a lot of clout. Do we have any role in taking a lead in trying to group people together in this new world?
Oh, I think we absolutely do. We've done it before, and we can do it again. I thought that, you know, Maurice Payne's sort of suggestion that there should be an inquiry into the lessons that we've learnt from the coronavirus was really important. This won't be the end of viral attacks on countries like Australia, and we may as well learn the lessons that we have to before the next, perhaps more lethal and more contagious.
Yeah, well, that's interesting.
As you were saying before, I mean, this is a period which has been marked, in my view, by excessively clunky diplomacy on all sides. We've had clunky diplomacy from the Chinese. We've had clunky diplomacy from the United States. And I don't think we put our best foot forward either on this, because what was a good idea turned very quickly into a case for the prosecution of China, and that is just not going to get anywhere, as Richard began by saying.
Yep. I was going to say, Geraldine, one of the reasons there's been clunky diplomacy is that nobody is really trying to conduct diplomacy. It's all about appealing to one's domestic basis, and that frankly applies to China as much as it does to the US and possibly Australia as well.
So it's nationalism really rearing its head, and competitive domestic competitiveness.
Yes, much more along those lines.
Just that I want to finish, because that is an interesting thought, Alan. Are you saying that the notion of actually calling for more accountability from China, or let's say anybody in the time of viruses, is worthwhile, but the way it was prosecuted possibly didn't quite pull it off? So this is this tricky sort of new learning as we go. Is that what you mean?
Well, what I mean is that it is quite clear that there are lessons to be learnt from all of this, that there's, you know, there's culpability all around. But in the middle of a pandemic, before we know where this is going to end up, it's very bold of us to make any decisions or any judgments, rather, at this stage, given what may yet happen. But there are lessons to be learned, and we should be trying to gather those lessons now. But those lessons aren't who's responsible for it. That can come later. You know, there's plenty of time for people to go through all that. The lessons now are, what have we learned about how we need to cooperate internationally, how our international institutions and networks, not just WHO but the others, need to work together. Mm-hmm. How can we make sure imports are available and production chains keep operating? All those things. Really, really important to do that. But a bad idea, because it won't get us anywhere, to turn it into a who's responsible for this, and where did it all start, and who can I blame?
And maybe we won't have any elegance about any of this for a little while, dare I say. John Prideaux, Richard McGregor and Alan Gingell, thank you very much for joining us for A Foreign Affair.
Thank you.
Thanks, Geraldine.
Thanks, Geraldine.
And you can find details of all of our guests on our website, and I'll leave you to do just that.